Population of the United States is aging, and by 2050, the number of Americans age 65 and older is expected to be about 88 million, more than double the number in 2010 of around 40 million, and it's the baby boom generation that will be making this happen. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. During the same period, the population is expected to rise from 310 million to 439 million, or an increase of about 42%, and nearly one in five Americans are expected to be age 65 or older by 2030. With those numbers, the current debate over health care, be it the Affordable Care Act or Medicare or Medicaid, has become more and more significant. That's especially true with the coming of the health insurance exchanges under Obamacare and the fight in Washington over its repeal. With us this morning is Rob Romasko. He is the national president of the American Association of Retired Persons, and he came to the Eastern Shore in Cambridge for the presentation of the 2013 AARP Andrus Award for Community Service, the highest honor awarded by AARP Maryland. And welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, let me start out with, obviously, the Affordable Care Act, which is on the top list. And one of the things that actually struck me, there was a poll done by Express Scripts of seniors, and they found that half of seniors were cutting back on their spending for food, travel, and health care and so on because they were feared the impact of Obamacare. 20% were skipping doctor's appointments. One-third believed that the ACA would raise the eligibility for Medicare. And 17% thought that the health exchanges, which are going to go into effect in October, would replace Medicare. That's the kind of atmosphere that you're stepping into. What's your assessment of how the ACA has been sold to Americans? And what should seniors particularly be disabused of?
Well, first of all, I think the what you mentioned are the level of misinformation, mistruths, and outright falsehoods that are out there. I think the way to answer your question about how it's been sold is a very simple statistic. If you look at the advertising statistics, $100 million has been spent by people who support ACA. $500 million has been spent by people who have reason to hate ACA. So when the airwaves, talk show radio, and all that kind of stuff is filled with people for whatever reason, whether they truly believe it's a bad idea or have political or ideological agendas, the fact remains that the information has been cloudy, contradictory, and AARP is working very hard to get the facts out, what ACA is, what it means, how it affects folks, particularly those on Medicare. One of the most ironic things is ACA strengthens Medicare. Closes the donut hole, provides benefits that preventive exams that are free of charge that weren't covered before. It has lengthened the trust fund about 8 or 10 years in terms of solvency. So ACA is actually good for Medicare. And the amount of money that was adjusted in ACA was taken out of insurance companies overcharging Medicare. No benefits were cut. Benefits were enhanced. Trust fund was enhanced. Actually, ACA is a good deal for Medicare recipients.
Well, as a matter of fact, in the last presidential election, we had about a $700 billion figure, I think, that was thrown around in which basically certainly the critics of the ACA said, hey, they're cutting this from the Medicare. How do you respond to that, and what specifically are those cuts?
Those cuts were made on the provider side. They were agreed to by the providers. It was basically formatted, particularly as you look at Medicare Advantage, which was basically charging 17% more for the same services that regular Medicare charged. So when you look at those issues, that money was reduced to slow the cost curve down in Medicare. And the critics were interesting. On one hand, they said they're taking it out of Medicare, and yet we won't do anything to, you know, we're going to let the system keep charging. And by the way, Medicare costs too much. So, you know, which one is it? But the facts are the $716 billion was out of the provider side. It was agreed to for the providers, and it righted the balance in terms of what people were getting charged. And it was used to basically provide and finance the whole system, which means affordable health care for all Americans. And that's what ACA is designed to do. And again, it benefits seniors, not just in Medicare, as I said earlier, but particularly in the 50 to 64 age range. If you understand that, they were getting charged 10 times what it cost the same service for a 29-year-old. That cost differential has been taken down to 3-to-1, so that's a benefit. The second thing is that these exchanges that people have to getting all lathered up about, they're significant and important, but it really applies to people who are in the individual market or not currently covered by their employer. employer-based health insurance basically covers about 85% of everybody. So by and large, it's the impact in terms of coverage and who gets covered is still going to be at your employer. For the 15%, which is a very big number, up to 30 million Americans, they now will have access through these exchanges to an array of options that have different price points with different coverage levels with subsidies for those at the lower end. It's all about getting everybody into the pool, allowing the insurance reforms that we've put in place, pre-existing conditions done away with, lifetime caps done away with, rescission, meaning they can't throw you off once you get sick, done away with. These things were the scourge of people, particularly as they age. You know, this is personal for me. My wife's a breast cancer survivor. When we moved to Virginia, we couldn't get insurance for her at any price. That goes away with the ACA, and I'm thankful for that.
What do you make of this campaign that's big opponents who are telling young people, don't get insurance in the exchanges, don't buy insurance?
Okay, so we want you to ride around unprotected. So when something awful happens, an accident, a sudden illness, you shouldn't be covered. And if you are covered, you go to the emergency room, the most expensive setting. That's a responsible thing to tell people to do? We don't think so.
Now, in terms, by the way, of compensation, one of the things I ran across is that I know there were a number of states, but I think California, I guess, who asked to cut back on reimbursements to providers under Medicaid, mm-hmm. and it was apparently allowed. And what I hear, particularly from physicians, both for Medicaid and even for Medicare, is that the rates are not high enough, that the reimbursement is not high enough. If they don't get the doc fix every year that keeps them from getting a major cut, then they won't be able to see Medicare patients or Medicaid patients. What about that tension?
Well, a tension exists in the system, and there's no question about it. The doc fix, as you mentioned, is that the formula that's been in place to adjust that, which year after year gets raised and adjusted. We have a congressional action every year to kind of put it off, because if it does go into effect, it really does reduce doctors' fees dramatically. We favor a doc fix. In other words, getting that formula redone. That's outside of ACA. It has nothing to do with ACA. It's a problem in the system. It needs to be fixed. AARP has been aggressively lobbying Congress on both sides of the aisle. A number of representatives on both sides of the aisle want to fix it. In fact, the House actually passed something that fixes it. Unfortunately, they didn't put a pay for it in there because it's about $180 billion for a 10-year fix. But we're right behind fixing that. So the doctors do need to be reimbursed appropriately. Otherwise, they will, understandably be shy about taking Medicare payments. Stepping back, even with the current situation, the number of docs that are leaving the system, while we get anecdotal evidence that, you know, my doctor isn't doing this, it's really about 1% or 2%. But if it's your doctor, it matters to you.
It's 100%, right.
But in the total scheme, it's a very small number. It's a very small number. But that doesn't negate the fact that the doc fix, that formula has to be adjusted, and we're in favor of that, and we're in favor of doing it over a long term as opposed to kicking, you know, making these temporary one-year fixes.
Well, one of the things that struck me is that over the last few years, there's been a slowdown in the cost of medical care, mm-hmm. Aside from Obamacare, which really hadn't really gotten into. I mean, it was enacted in 2010. Much of it, that has been attributed to the recession itself. It's just people are not going to the doctors as much, and medical costs are going. That, however, is expected to change. I think it's like something like 6%, I think, next year, I think it is. And we could see a rise again. How do you deal with that rising cost? Because it seems to me that Obamacare was basically an insurance reform plan. It really didn't strike at the heart of this increasing cost that we had. Most of it, there was a lot of pilot programs, mm-hmm. right, to mm-hmm. try to figure out how to control costs. How do you deal with that cost, and should we expect the medical costs to start escalating again?
Well, I think the joy's out on that. I think your analysis is reasonable. The costs have slowed down dramatically, precipitously, and thankfully. There's been mixed evidence about whether it's 100% the recession. I've seen a study that said it's about a third of the recession. No one really knows. I will tell you anecdotally, as I travel across the country and deal with medical professionals, hospital systems, and even senior executive insurance companies, and I've been to several conferences and talked to people I know in the industry, while ACA has not kicked in, everybody knows it's coming. So people are starting to adjust in anticipation of it changing. The entire healthcare industry knows that something's different. The providers, particularly hospitals, have figured out it's no longer a cost-plus business, meaning the conversation goes from how do we cover our costs, think about that, never dealing with it, just assuming they have to find revenue, to how do we reduce our costs. That's a very significant change. So ACA does have experiments. The CBO, because of their experiments, hasn't given ACA any credit for savings. But anecdotally, I can tell you that the entire healthcare industry has shifted toward prevention as a means of cost control. The irony of the ACA is it's made the insurance companies good guys, not bad guys. And you look at me and go, how did that happen? Well, before ACA, insurance companies made money by not paying claims, by only insuring healthy people, not covering sick people. Well, the insurance ACA has made it mandatory. Everybody gets insured, whether you're ill or not. So all of a sudden, the insurance companies, the only way they can make money is keep you healthy. Keep you healthy. Keep you from going to the hospital and staying and getting readmitted and all that kind of stuff. So they've now been enlisted on the side of prevention, better care, healthier, because that keeps their costs down and allows them to continue to prosper. It's been a very interesting shift. When you talk to the senior executives of health insurers, they now have bought the entire, it's about costs, prevention, and quality care, starting with, and those are things they've been avoiding. The first thing they do is try to make sure you're not entitled to the claim. Well, they don't do that as much anymore. It's now about how can we get people to stay healthy, and once they get sick, to get well faster. That's a big shift. All that dynamic is going to play out. We don't have any definitive evidence, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that shows me that the costs are coming down. Some of these experiments we've seen in terms of readmissions and so forth, ACA has a different reimbursement scheme if your readmission rate is too high. Well, all of a sudden, hospitals are starting to focus on readmission rates, and I've seen instances where they drop 30% and 40% because they know if they don't get that thing turned around, they're not going to get reimbursed. They'll get penalized. If their readmission rates drop, they get rewarded. So ACA does a lot to change the whole structure of the incentive system. You get what you pay for. If all you pay for is transactions and test after test after test, and you don't pay for healthy behaviors, you'll get test after test after test. The ACA has these pay for outcomes, not for transactions in a lot of cases, and I have a lot of hope for that. Again, jury's out, and as you point out, we haven't got a lot of evidence, 25 years of data, but I'm pretty encouraged by the general shift in attitude by the healthcare professionals. This runaway train can't go on anymore. They know it, and they're starting to adjust their behaviors.
Let me, not to belabor this, but do you see any mechanism in this to get the price of a particular procedure lowered? Not that you are avoiding other procedures, or that you're avoiding them by, say, cutting readmissions or prohibiting them. But the actual, I mean, I think I was reading where some of the folks at the AMA, they sit around and they say, okay, this is what we think it costs, and that's the price that comes down. And even between different hospitals that are not very far apart, one procedure can cost much more than another. I mean, there's the actual cost itself. Because in a lot of other countries, the pressure for the downward pressure comes from the government, pushes the price down. Mm-hmm. Here, we don't have that.
Well, I think you've touched on the most important dimension that's been neglected. As we think about medical costs in general and Medicare in particular, Stephen Brill's article in Time magazine last spring called The Bitter Pill, his opening paragraph said, we're arguing about who pays. We're asking the wrong question. Why does it cost so much? $2.7 trillion, 50% more per capita in this country than any other developed economy, where our health outcomes as measured by international standards were 37th, slightly ahead of Slovakia and Cuba. And by the way, on an accidental basis, we kill 200,000 people a year with medical errors. Other than that, our healthcare system's working like a top. So we have to have a laser-like focus on costs because it affects everybody. It affects Medicare. It affects people at home. It affects businesses. So if we keep that focus there and put the spotlight on it and we get the information, probably one of the most significant things that happened was CMS released the anonymous but cost data. So you could get this information that said a procedure within 12 blocks in New York City has a 3X differential. Well, all of a sudden that data is starting to be posted and the people in those institutions have to look at each other and say, wait a second, you know, we're going to have a problem if it's cheaper, same quality, 3 blocks away. So that process will start to help people make some choices where the consumer can be more objective. They can be better advocates to the doctors and say, do I really need this test? How much is it here and how much is it there? So that's part of what's going on here. So I think so the spotlight is number one. And if you think about Medicare, and you think about the federal budget and all the challenges, about half the problem is medical cost. The other half the problem is the fact that there's just more of us that are aging. Well, there are certain common sense solutions in Medicare that can reduce the rate of increase of cost without cutting benefits. You can do that, make substantial progress within Medicare, and use Medicare as an influencer to get the whole cost of the whole system down.
As you point out, we're looking at a growth in the number of people who are getting older. Mm-hmm. We cited at the beginning of the program. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me is that a lot of the debate about the fiscal issues that the country faces is the growth of Medicare. Mm-hmm. It's not even so much Social Security. We can talk about that in a moment. Mm-hmm. But there's this tremendous push. Are you confident that you will be able to bring down the costs of health care, whether it's through ACA or other reforms, so that doesn't balloon out of some of the projections that we've had? Because everybody's looking at the budget, and if there's a big one, it's Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're confident that if we have the right emphasis, it's a two-track strategy, healthcare costs broadly, and you put the spotlight on it and keep demanding quality, transparency, and fair pricing. And frankly, you know, the free market actually will respond if the information's there. And you know, there's a lot of energy going into that sector, a lot of technology, a lot of startups saying, wait a minute, when you have a market sector that's so inefficient at delivering quality care, people are going to start figuring out what the efficiencies are. Technology is a big part of it. Transparency of pricing is the second part of it. Informed consumers are a third part of it. That's all part of the system. The second thing is Medicare can be a driver in that process. It is kind of odd, and if you're a businessman, it really is startling. Medicare cannot negotiate with the drug companies. The largest purchaser of drugs is forbidden by federal law to negotiate with the drug companies. That's like telling Walmart they can't negotiate with Procter & Gamble over the price of Tide. That makes no sense.
Do you see that kind of quirk? I mean, there are other quirks in laws being undone, I mean, given the various special interests?
Well, one of the things that people ask me is, why can't they get anything done? And I say, well, follow the money first and then figure out who benefits. Our founder was a big believer in our army of useful citizens. Informed citizens can actually have an impact. When you can confront people with the facts, they tend to come to reasonable conclusions. Most people don't know that Medicare is forbidden to negotiate. That doesn't make any sense to anybody. Another place where we need to look, and it's a common sense solution, is beyond the drug companies, is we need to look at tort reform, okay? There's got to be a way to, and actually the awards have gone down, but no one understands what the impact is of defensive medicine. You know, how many times do you have to prescribe a test to make sure that you don't get sued? Well, there must be a way to have tort reform which still protects the individual's right to sue in case they've been, you know, maltreated by a healthcare professional, and take this sort of cloud of fear away from physicians that they won't be dealt with fairly. So we think that should be looked into too. The pharmaceutical companies, you know, coordinated care, use of technology, the pharma companies, you know, not only we should be able to negotiate with them, but these pay-to-delay things where they make deals to keep generics off the market longer, that's costing $3 to $5 billion a year. And I just testified in the Senate about that on a bipartisan bill from Senators Vitter and Grassley and Klobuchar on a bill that would start to reinforce the ability for people not to do that. So there are things that can be done within Medicare. There are things that Medicare can do to influence the total cost, which can slow the cost down. Medical costs are going to continue to rise. If people think all of a sudden they're going to go down to a tenth of what they were, that's unrealistic. What we really want is medical costs not to grow faster than the general economy. If we achieve that, we solve about 40 to 50% of the budget problem in Medicare. That's a significant issue, and not only for Medicare, but for everybody. Because like anything else, when you're spending your GDP on this, you're not investing in other parts of the economy that would cause the economy to grow. So it's a very significant issue.
One of the other things I ran across in terms of as people get older, and that is caregivers. And there's something I think I ran across, a figure where something in 2010, there's like 7.2 individuals, potential caregivers, for those who are over 80. By the time you get to 2050, I think the number is 2.9. How do we address that, especially, and you have a large segment, for instance, the senior population who doesn't necessarily have family, who didn't, have children. How are we going to address that?
Well, first thing is to, change happens in a sequence, and the first thing you have to do is state the problem, right? Get it out of the shadows. Long-term care is kind of fascinating. It is something that every individual, every family will deal with one way or the other, either for themselves or for their loved ones. And yet we don't talk about it. It's not talked about, right? Whenever I have a conversation, usually in a business or professional audience, and they're all interested in budgets and so forth, I ask how many people are involved in a long-term care situation. 2/3 to 3/4 of the hands go up in the room. So how to, and people struggle with that. We at AARP, we did a study. We estimate that at minimum wage, we're probably spending in non-compensated work about $450 billion a year in terms of people's time, away from their jobs, trying to jury rig whatever it is to care for their loved one. So it's a question of how we deal with that. First of all, get the problem on the table, right? Second of all, think about different arenas where we can make a difference. Number one, employers have to start developing some programs that support people in their ability to care for their loved ones and still participate in the workforce, and flexible work schedules, understanding kind of policies. We also need to look to Europe, where they've had long-term care situations that are financed by contributions and so forth. Maybe there has to be a system that provides some minimal support. So we need to look at solutions that are a combination of private sector flexibility, support for people that are doing that, just as you have maternity leave when you have a child. Maybe you should have some parallel situation where you have a situation where you have a legitimate need to care for a loved one. And then look at some broad-based societal insurance things that are funded by people, by employers, as we always do, and figure out ways of providing that. And third, make sure you have a workforce that's trained, properly compensated, and available, right? It's a little concerning when what long-term care we have depends on the least compensated non-professional people to care for our loved ones. It makes you nervous, right? So we need to think about what does that workforce look like? How do we put standards in there that the workforce is available and properly trained? You're not going to turn the person you love over to someone that's making $3 an hour or something like that. It makes you a little nervous, right?
Because one of the things I ran into was that the Medicaid is like one of the biggest costs is long term. I mean, right. People. I remember sitting next to somebody at a restaurant, and they were talking about how they're waiting till they got down, their assets got down to a certain extent for their loved one before they could then take advantage. Is that a reasonable way to handle long term care?
Well, that's the way we're doing it, right? When you look at Medicaid, people think Medicaid, their image of it, is for poor people, and it is for those that are less advantaged. About 1/3 of Medicaid expenses is for nursing homes. It's the largest piece of Medicaid because where else are they, that's the only place. It doesn't reimburse. Medicare doesn't take care of long-term care. So when people are at their wit's end, they wind up going through the Medicaid system in order to get some nursing home care. It's a poor substitute for a thoughtful long-term care solution. It probably isn't that efficient, and we're not clear about the quality of care.
The other thing that happened, I guess it was with this last month, is that we had these votes on the food stamp program. House voted some $40 billion, I think, in cuts. What do you make of that vote, and do you see food stamps being cut? How significant is that, obviously, seniors? And particularly split off from the Farm Bill, which is sort of the deal that was reached.
As a nonpartisan organization, we try to figure out what the best policy is in terms of what I do know is that the SNAP program is about people who have limited means and are threatened with hunger. So who gets affected? Well, it's children and seniors, right? So is that wise? And you look at the structure of the bill, and historically it has been a farm subsidy food stamp, and there was sort of a deal, you can use that word, and all of a sudden we've split it away. Well, the separate farm subsidy bill, the subsidies actually got increased. So big food got more money, and poor people got less. Does that make sense? $40 billion? Okay, hundreds of millions of people who are in food security? We just gave an award to Larry Adams here in the state of Maryland, who single-handedly has, for 27 years, helped supply food banks. And his comment to me was, you know, the demand for food at the food pantries has doubled in the last 5 years. People who were middle class, people who used to be donors to the food banks, are now showing up as recipients. This has been the most severe recession. And even though we're in recovery, it's been a two Americas recovery. I like to say it very simply. 20% of us are doing okay. 1% of us are doing really okay. 80% of us, like one member said to me the other day, Rob, I'm just trying to get to Friday. Why would you cut the very things that's of helping save millions of families at a time when it's the most severe it's been in 80 years? From a social policy point of view, it doesn't make sense. From a fairness point of view, you want to subsidize the big food and you want to cut individual families and children. I'm not sure that's the country we want. We're focused on it because it affects seniors, and we have 9 million seniors in this country on the edge of hunger. We don't think that's a kind of country we want, and in the end, we all pay the price. One of the things that's real interesting about serving people over 50, it's not just people, it's people and their families. As we age or seniors become older, if the need doesn't go away. You know, you want to cut Medicare, you want to cut Social Security, the need for paying a light bill, the rent bill, the food bill, that doesn't go away. The need for hospital care doesn't go away. You take away the benefit, the need is still there. So that burden falls where? On the families, on the community, and probably in inefficient ways. So we need to be thoughtful about these things and understand it's not a line item in the budget. It's a person, it's a family, it's a grandchild, it's a grandparent. These are real people in real lives. Someday I want to take these policymakers and say, I want you to go to the Barrios of Los Angeles, the inner city of Michigan, the rural hills of West Virginia, and look those people in the eye and try to live on what they live. Stop abusing and having a war on poor people. Start thinking about America.
Finally, what does all of this mean? Because it's a very dark picture in many ways that we've been describing. For people who are going to retire, maybe 65, 66, and they may have 30 years left to live.
Right.
I mean, what future are we painting here?
Well, it depends on your point of view. We have a very different point of view. We think that the aging revolution, which is what it is, I mean, think about it, right? We have opportunities. Most of us want to live to be 100, and increasingly numbers are going to live to be 100. Two studies. Number one, of all the people in the history of the world that have reached the age of 65, two-thirds of them are walking the earth today. 10,000 of us in this country will turn 65 every day for the next 18 years. Children who are born in this century, the 21st century, have a 50-50 chance of living to be 100. This is a revolution in terms of an aging profile we've never seen before in human history. So the bad news is we can't go to the library and say, hey, how do we do this? We have to sort of make this up and invent it. The good news is we have an opportunity to shape what I call a longevity society and longevity economy. Baby boomers represent 78 million people. Next year, every baby boomer will be over the age of 50. Now, when I went to business school, when you had 78 million of anything, that was a market. That was an opportunity. So how do we capture that? How do we capture the energy, the vitality, the knowledge of 78 million people, of as you point out, 40 million people over the age who are not done? I don't know. Most people I meet want to keep doing something productive. A lot of people have to work because of the financial interest, but a lot of people don't. They say, I want to do something different. I want to continue to contribute, whether it's volunteering or working part-time or starting a business or doing something different. That's why we at AARP have started something called Life Reimagined, to help people navigate through this new uncertainty, this new world, this new longevity piece. What is it they're good at? What is it they want to do? And what are the resources that will help them get there? Whether it's in the marketplace, the workplace, or their places, we want to give them the tools to navigate this, whether it's finding jobs in our Life Reimagined at Work, putting them in touch with employers, giving them advice on how to write a resume in the new online job world, which companies are receptive to older, experienced workers. We'll fight them in the court if they're discriminating, and we'll give people the tools and the confidence, give them the confidence to move ahead. It's a new world, it's an exciting world, and there's opportunity. Our job is to change the way we think about aging. It's not a burden, it's an opportunity. So I'm actually optimistic.
We've been speaking with Rob Ramosco. He is the national president of the American Association of Retired Persons. Appreciate you joining us.
It's been a pleasure, and thanks very much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.